In this time of COVID-19, when the daily news is grim and filled with sorrow, today's guest is just the person we need to hear from. His years of psychological research into post-traumatic growth gives us all reason to be hopeful. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Institute series on ideas. Today, we'll be talking with Richard Tedeschi about his new book, Post-Traumatic Growth, Theory, Research, and Application. Dr. Richard Tedeschi is a psychologist and professor emeritus at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Professor Tedeschi and his colleague Lawrence Calhoun coined the term post-traumatic growth for the theory that holds that people who endure psychological struggle following extreme adversity can often see positive growth afterwards. Richard Tedeschi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Renee. I look forward to speaking with you.
So let's start with, how did you first become aware of the phenomenon of post-traumatic growth?
Well, I'm glad you put it that way, aware of it, because it's not something that myself and Lawrence Calhoun invented, but it's something we gave a name to. And it's a well-known phenomenon in life across cultures. You find descriptions of it in literature and religion and philosophy. So I guess we could say that as psychologists, we were late to the party on this. But we became aware of it because we were first interested in looking into the psychological study of wisdom. And in doing so, we thought, as we looked through the literature at the time in psychology, that given there wasn't a whole lot there, we thought, we would interview people we thought might be wise. So we talked with people who had suffered disabilities in adulthood and done remarkably well in managing them and adjusting to them and living life with their disability. And we talked with older people who we, folk wisdom is, they're wise. We talked with older bereaved people, especially widows in their 70s and 80s, looking at how they managed to cope with their widowhood. So we selected these people who we thought might have something to say about wise way to live life in the aftermath of what things they had gone through. And the messages we heard from so many of them involved this concept of growth after trauma, that they learned so much about living life well, having to struggle in the aftermath of these kinds of traumatic events. So it was from those interviews that we first started to develop our ideas.
Well, trauma has been defined in the psychological and in the actually literary literature in many different ways. Not most of them overlap, but they're not exactly the same. What have you found to be the most useful concept of trauma, and why?
You're right that trauma comes in many definitions, and for example, in the psychiatric literature, it has traditionally been defined in terms of certain kinds of events, life-threatening events and such. We found that a way of defining trauma that comes out of the work of Ronnie Janoff Bullman was particularly enlightening to us. And she described trauma in terms of the shattering of the assumptive world. And this is the set of beliefs we have about how life works, how the world works, assumptions we make about how life is going to go, assumptions we make that we just don't question because they seem so obvious to us until some event occurs which calls them into question. This is the shattering of the assumptive world. So trauma is a shattering of these core beliefs where we say, you know, I can't believe this has happened, or I never thought this would happen to me, or, you know, who am I now, or what's going to happen to me, or my life has taken a turn that I would never have expected. So it's a shattering of the core beliefs about ourselves, what kind of people we are, what kind of life we have, what kind of future we have, what kind of people we're around, what kind of world we live in, those kinds of basic assumptions where we think our life is pretty well known to us into the future, and then suddenly the future changes.
Right. It's amazing that it took the psychological establishment 25 years to notice that trauma and its sequelae happened. I mean, the definition of trauma that you use, and even some of the others, are a part of life forever. So it's remarkable, and to your great credit, that you discovered what was there in plain sight.
Well, you know, I want to say that our first book that we wrote about this was in 1995, called Trauma and Transformation. And that was at a point where we hadn't even coined the term post-traumatic growth. We just mentioned it in the appendix to the book. And in that book, what we did was we went through the literature of psychology at the time. And we saw that there were references to this kind of phenomenon, but they were not emphasized. They weren't labeled in any way that allowed people to access them. There were seeds of this scattered in the psychological literature on different kinds of traumas. You'll find it in accounts of people with devastating illnesses. We find it in the bereavement literature, in description of responses to natural disasters, and to war. You could find it in lots of different places, but it was a theme that was not really it wasn't pursued in itself in the psychological literature. So we wanted to bring this to the surface and treat it as a phenomenon in its own right that was worth more attention.
And when you say trauma is transformative, or can be, what does that mean? What is the transformation?
Great question. It's, well, you're good at asking questions. That's your job. But the
better than at answering them. Yeah.
Right. So what is the transformation? It's a transformation in the philosophy that we have in living our lives. It's a transformation in our view of ourself. It's a transformation in our view of others and our way of relating to others. It's essentially transformations in those kinds of areas. And when we had completed our interviews and we had transcribed them and subjected them to different kinds of content analyses and whatnot, and what we did was we came up with a series of quotes from these interviews that we used to try to develop a measure of post-traumatic growth. And these quotes became a measure called the Post-Traumatic Growth Inventory, which turns out to have five domains contained in it. These domains emerged from this work through some statistical analyses. And the five domains are these. One is personal strength. So what's transformative is people recognizing that they're stronger than they thought they were, mostly because they have come through events that were so difficult or devastating or challenging. They were kind of surprised at their capabilities. So that's one of the five. Another is a recognition of new possibilities in life. Very often the events people come through that are traumatic seem to rob them of a certain kind of future or the way that they're living life currently. So for example, you might be robbed of a relationship when someone dies. So you're robbed of your marriage or the child that you have. Or maybe you're robbed of, because of economic conditions, maybe you're robbed of your job or career. Or maybe you're robbed of some physical capability from illness. So people lose something. There's loss that, at the same time, forces people to reconsider how they're going to live. And these reconsiderations can lead people to opportunities they wouldn't have had otherwise, new possibilities for living life in a different way. Previously not pursued, not even welcomed, but possibilities nonetheless that can often be very rewarding in the end. And a third area is changed relationships with other people. Very often people, well, if they're fortunate, in the aftermath of trauma, come upon other people who are very good at providing support, listening to them. And in this support, they may draw closer to people than they have been before, out of the necessity of being close and seeking support in the aftermath of trauma very often. So that can create new and closer relationships and also a greater empathy and compassion for people who go through trauma. You know, when you're a survivor of it yourself, you realize what it's like to be a human being who has to endure suffering. And that can make you more open to others who have endured suffering. Another area of post-traumatic growth is appreciation of life, where people see life through the lens of gratitude. They're grateful for what they have, given what they might have lost. And they often say they don't take things for granted. And then the fifth area that we talk about is spiritual and existential change, where people often have to question or deepen or change their religious beliefs or spiritual consciousness or confront the big existential questions, the questions about existence, living life and what it's about and what it all means in the aftermath of something terrible that has happened to them. So those are the five areas of transformation that we see in post-traumatic growth. And people may have transformations that are focused on one of those areas or a number of those areas.
Now, it seems just from the outside that most people or many people who survive trauma, they cope afterwards, once they recover, more or less around their pre-trauma levels of functioning. First of all, is that true? And secondly, if it is true, what differentiates those people from the ones who experience post-traumatic growth?
Well, what you described certainly is true, and that kind of capability has been described very clearly in the psychological literature for many years as resilience. So people Yes. who are resilient are those who come through trauma without having scars, we could say, or they come through relatively well. Because something that's resilient is something that bounces back or is relatively unaffected. So people who have certain kinds of capabilities of managing trauma without being affected by it are resilient. And what distinguishes people who have experienced post-traumatic growth from those who are resilient is those who experience this growth do not have for one reason or another, the capability of handling the trauma that they confront in a way where it doesn't really challenge them all that much. And that could be because the trauma is greater and more devastating, or that the person hasn't developed the characteristics that we find in resilient people. And we've talked about the fact that post-traumatic growth can lead to resilience. It can lead to a strengthening of people. It can lead people to redesign their core beliefs, their assumptive world, their belief system, so that subsequent traumatic events don't rock their world and are more understandable to them. And they can be resilient sometime in the future because of the changes they've gone through in the process of post-traumatic growth.
Are there some characteristics, say personality style or sociological variables, demographic variables, that make it more or less likely that someone will experience post-traumatic growth?
Yes, but these kinds of variables or characteristics don't exclude anyone really from experiencing post-traumatic growth. But I can talk about what we found to be some of these characteristics. So, for example, let's go talk about age. Children are capable of post-traumatic growth ideas and understandings, generally around middle childhood, maybe 8 or 9 and above, generally on the average, when they are capable of thinking in terms of how good and bad things can coexist. That's the key, because post-traumatic growth represents something good coming out of something bad. And that kind of conceptualization isn't available to kids who at younger ages. They have to mature in their cognitive abilities in order to start to get that kind of concept. You can call it dialectical thinking, sort of thinking of, about two things that don't seem to belong together but can be coexisting. Then when you move up the age range, it seems like a time when people are particularly open to growth is late adolescence and early adulthood. And this is, of course, generally a time of a lot of development of identity, launching into the adult life with a certain idea of the plan for the future and the framework for life. So a lot of things are still fluid and in flux at that time of life. And people may be particularly flexible in terms of their ability to adapt and change and transform. So we see that as a kind of a rich time for post-traumatic growth. And so it does continue to reach certainly into adulthood. But maybe by very late adulthood, we've learned a lot of lessons in life, and you know, the tragedies and suffering of life, maybe they don't surprise us as much anymore. Maybe it has to be something really, really shocking to us and surprising for our own lives to challenge the core belief system we've built by then. So post-traumatic growth is something that people of all different ages can report, but if we look at age, it's generally that way. It is universal. I mean, we have done research across all kinds of cultures. It is found in all kinds of religious traditions. So it doesn't seem restricted to any particular culture or nationality. And yet, there are some subtle differences in different places about the domains of growth, those different areas of transformation that I mentioned, those five areas, in terms of what seems to be emphasized. So for example, in some Asian cultures, we find less emphasis on transformation in the area of personal strength and more in that area in Western countries. And that may be because Asian countries are less individualistic generally, in terms of their belief systems. So they don't focus in that area as much as people in Western countries might. We've also found less emphasis on the spiritual and existential change factor in some European countries than we've found in the United States, for example. And that may be because maybe there's less religious commitment in a lot of people in Western Europe than there is in the United States. So we don't see those shifts in kind of religious and spiritual beliefs as much, but we've altered the scale somewhat in the past few years to sort of try to accommodate that and capture a little bit more of the existential part of things instead of purely the spiritual and religious piece, learning from what we've heard from people in those Western European societies. So those are some indications that there are differences among demographics. In terms of personality, we have found generally that people who are these personality traits called the big five personality traits. And yes. Among those, the ones that seem to correlate some with post-traumatic growth are openness to experience, which those are people who invite novelty and are interested and curious about experience. And so they are also open to these kinds of changes we see in post-traumatic growth. And the other area is extroversion. People are more extroverted. And there's an area of extroversion that seem to be responsible for this relationship. And those areas are positive emotionality and interest in connecting with other people, and also sort of an action orientation towards life. So extroverted people seem to be kind of marginally more likely to show post-traumatic growth. These are small differences. Don't want to emphasize them too much, but those are some of the things we have found.
Well, that's on the individual side, on the person who has experienced the trauma. Let's look at the nature of the trauma. Are there some kinds of traumas that are more likely than others to be followed by post-traumatic growth? Is there a difference, for example, between a personal loss, let's say, and a communal loss, a physical illness versus a natural disaster? Or something that's natural, like the COVID-19 pandemic, versus something intentional, like combat or terrorist attack. Is there anything in the nature of the trauma that makes it more or less likely to foster or elicit post-traumatic growth?
You know, we have found post-traumatic growth reported by people across all kinds of traumatic events. And we've been primarily interested in the process of post-traumatic growth more than how it relates to specific events, given that people report it in all kinds of situations. So I can say with a lot of confidence that any kind of event can yield post-traumatic growth. And it's kind of surprising how people are able to do this in the aftermath of things that are just so terrible. So this is a phenomenon that can arise out of all kinds of events. Now, there do seem to be differences in terms of the kinds of growth domains that occur sometimes given the events that people are experiencing. But it's hard to generalize to the event. You have to look more at what the individual is making out of them. So it seems to be a highly individualized process. So for example, let's say we're talking about rape, which can yield growth in some areas while there is a diminishment of functioning in other areas. So a person might who has been raped might feel very betrayed because who perpetrated this act was someone that they trusted. And, you know, that could lead to people being more mistrusting in the future and affect their interpersonal relationships. So in the area of their relationship with others, maybe they've really taken a hit. While at the same time, if they've somehow managed to get through this successfully, maybe they've sought, they've reported it and they've gone through a trial, maybe they have a great increase in their sense of personal strength. So you might see changes in personal strength, you know, really increasing, while it's affected in negative ways other parts of their lives. On the other hand, maybe if you look at someone who's gone through a natural disaster and they've had neighbors in a community that has rallied to somehow where everyone's helped each other in the aftermath of the disaster, maybe they've forged closer relationships with other people because of that experience with others. Maybe other people have helped so much that they haven't had to rely on their personal strength to get through as much. So maybe that, if for that individual, personal strength doesn't increase as much, but relationships with others are enhanced. So you'll have to see what happens in individual circumstances to really understand how these different growth domains might be affected.
So would that mean, let's say, that someone who's experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder, a phenomenon that's been well-documented, well-researched, and talked about, can also, at the same time, be experiencing post-traumatic growth?
Absolutely. And that is because the circumstances that create post-traumatic stress disorder are the same kinds of circumstances that are the fertile ground for post-traumatic growth. So, you know, traumas that create PTSD also can propel people towards post-traumatic growth. Now, the relationship between PTSD and post-traumatic growth can vary over time. So, people who experience a really very difficult traumatic event that results in symptoms of PTSD, those are people that have experienced enough trauma, and you have to experience enough of it to shatter core beliefs or the assumptive world. So they're, at the same time, people who are going to be better candidates for post-traumatic growth down the line. But if you look over time, later on, maybe years later, post-traumatic growth is often correlated with a lessening of PTSD symptoms. As people who experience post-traumatic growth learn to live well and accept the traumatic event as something that has change their life narrative, their life story, they can also tolerate what symptoms of PTSD may be left in there, and they're less difficult to cope with, less bothersome, and so those symptoms sort of diminish as post-traumatic growth increases over time. So those are that's the kind of relationship we tend to see between PTSD and post-traumatic growth.
So in your book, you have a model of the process of post-traumatic growth. And in that model, are there particular transitions that separate those who go on to experience post-traumatic growth from those who don't?
Well, yes, that's a great way to put it. So the first transition is, as I mentioned, to what extent are the core beliefs or the assumptive world challenged? If those core beliefs are really not challenged very much and people are resilient, you won't see more post-traumatic growth. And then after that, if the core beliefs are challenged, this is a very anxiety-arousing experience for people. It's emotionally difficult to go through that process. So the trauma itself and the specifics of the trauma, you know, the loss itself or the injury itself, whatever it might be, and maybe the post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms create all kinds of emotional disruption, together with the challenge to the core belief system. So people have to learn how to settle down that emotional disruption and enough so they can think straight about what to do about this whole situation. So if they can get some emotional regulation going, they can sort of calm themselves enough so that their thinking moves from being just kind of scattered and intrusive and repetitive to something that's a little bit more reflective and deliberate, then they can start to move towards the area of post-traumatic growth because they're deliberating about questions of the assumptive world, the core belief system. They start to think about, you know, what am I going to make of this? What does this all mean for me? What kind of life am I going to go on to live? If they can start to grapple with those questions rather than think like, oh my God, why did this happen to me? Or this is just terrible, or I'll never get over this, or, you know, it's all out of control, I'm out of control, and those kinds of anxiety-arousing thoughts. If they can move towards this more reflective state and ask these questions that are more useful and constructive, they move towards post-traumatic growth. And then, as I mentioned briefly earlier, if there are some people around who provide a good listening ear and who are consistent and available, this can help people with their reflections that they're going through to kind of process that and to come to some conclusions about things. So we need these kinds of people. They facilitate this process. Lawrence Calhoun and I, when we were developing this, when we thought about these kinds of people that were described by trauma survivors, we came up with a way of saying it. We call them expert companions. So we need these expert companions.
That was a great name in the book. I thought that was really a perfect title for the kind of friend a person in trauma or post-trauma would love to have. Yes, please. Say some more about that expert companionship.
Yeah. What we try to emphasize is the companionship part. You know, people don't have to be professionals or experts in trauma or something like that. They have to be really good at being companions, being along for the difficult journey through trauma, the aftermath of trauma. So, you know, I think we all know what these people feel like. You know, I mean, they're people who are open to us, who aren't critical. They don't give us unsolicited advice. They don't pretend to know what's going to happen or how to do things. They feel really solid. They're open to our emotional state. They don't try to force us in one direction or another. They're there for the long haul. These kinds of people, you know, these are the expert companions. You know, they're really expert at human relationship, at listening. And you know, the thing that we found was that these kinds of listeners are the people who learn from us. They don't try to teach us so much as they listen in a way they're interested in what is this like for you? You know, what happened? What's the impact on you? What's life like for you now? What are you going through? What's it like? You know, they're learners about us and our experience. So those are the ways we've described the expert companions.
Right. Well, now we have a situation where there's widespread trauma at different levels, economic trauma, uncertainty about the future, besides people getting sick and dying. Are there things that families and friends and communities can do that facilitate post-traumatic growth and or things that impede it?
Well, we have to have, hopefully we have to have these expert companions around. We can be expert companions for each other. You know, we can draw upon our capabilities that we've learned throughout our lives to try to apply those capabilities now. And they're capabilities that are sometimes practical and sometimes are more philosophical. But we can think about what we've learned from our previous experiences in life and draw upon those to help ourselves and those people around us. So many of us are expert companions for each other. As we encourage each other to get through this too. So that's certainly the basis for it all. If you're a leader, you have the opportunity to affect many people by the demeanor you carry in the midst of all of this. And it's not a demeanor where you just try to be just kind of unnaturally strong and optimistic through everything. I think it's important where you lead with an openness to your own experience of struggle and recognition that this is hard and it's anxiety arousing for all of us because none of us know exactly the future of it. So I think you show that as you're a leader. And by leader, I mean someone who is perhaps a leader in their family or in their neighborhood or in their friend circle, not just a leader necessarily at the political sense or the professional sense.
Right.
I think we have to bring that to each other. I think we have to practice that emotional regulation that I mentioned. We have to find ways to be able to calm ourselves in the struggles that we're going through here. There may be job loss. There's challenges to our ability to just get by economically. You know, if you're threatened by circumstance where you can't pay the rent or you can't buy your food, you know, how to calm yourself and somehow emotionally get through these kinds of challenges. So those kinds of practices involve meditative practices and physical exercise and those things that can sort of take from the body all that physiological experience of anxiety that's so unnerving. And then keep our thought processes kind of straight enough that we can solve the problems of this time. So those are things that are really necessary as well. And we can teach each of those things and practice those things. And we have to be able to kind of talk among each other, you know, keep connected.
Yeah.
In this time that we're practicing all this so-called social distancing. And, you know, I think that what we're doing here, you know, I'm in the United States and you're in Jerusalem, and we are we're talking together in this through this technological wonder of the internet. You know, this is something that this is an amazing advantage that we now have across the world to stay connected, and we're using this. So making contact with our neighbors that we can't get in touch with physically, and our family members and our friends that we can't get in touch with physically, is really important in encouraging each other through this so that we don't feel so lonely and isolated. That's really a danger for us all. So we have to connect to our communities this way.
Now, tell us about the Boulder Crest program. It's a program that is putting into place a lot of your ideas and insights that you've gained over the years. So tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a Boulder Crest retreat for military and veteran wellness. And I'll tell you, Renee, this has been so satisfying for me to see the development of this program. And this retreat center was established in Virginia in the United States in 2015 by a man named Ken Falk, who is a Navy veteran, who, when he left the Navy after 20 years as a bomb disposal expert, and then developed a contracting company with the military. He sold the company and took the profits and created this retreat center for military service members and veterans about an hour outside of Washington, D.C., on his property. And he and his wife, Julia, decided to do this because they were visiting wounded veterans at hospitals in Washington, D.C., and bringing them out to their land. And they started to become – there was just too many for them to do the kind of job they wanted to do with it. And so they created this retreat center. And I met with Ken early on in this process after he had started to build this place. And we talked together about the post-traumatic growth model, and he said, "This is what you're talking about is what we're really trying to do. Can you help us develop our program?" So we've worked together to develop a program that is based on post-traumatic growth principles and the processes of change that we find in post-traumatic growth. The people I'm working most closely with, Ken and the executive director, Josh Goldberg, and another psychologist, Brett Moore, who's in San Antonio, Texas. We have together developed this program. And what it is, it's a week-long program where people come to this center, live in these beautiful setting, rural setting, in log cabins, lovely log structures, and meet in a log lodge, and learn about this post-traumatic growth process, and in the process also do different kinds of activities which kind of demonstrate and allow them to experience emotional regulation. And they go through meditative exercises, and they work outside in different capacities that allow them to bind together in a small group. We take in groups of 6 to 8 at a time for this week-long retreat, and then they follow up with us for 18 months afterwards through an internet-based platform that we have, where we continually talk with them and meet with them as a unit and provide them with all kinds of materials to use as they go through this 18-month process of consolidation of their learning and applying it back home. We also have another retreat center in Arizona, in the high desert country of Arizona, outside of Tucson. And then there are several associated retreat centers that we're working with that we don't own, but we've helped their staffs learn our program and directed them how to apply it in different areas around the United States. It's a very successful program. We've been doing some research on our outcomes and found it to be remarkably successful, so much more successful than what we find in many of what have been called the gold standard PTSD treatments, clinical treatments. So we're very excited about continuing to spread this program across the country and learn how to also apply it to other kinds of populations of people who are traumatized. First responders, for example, police, fire. We're talking about the healthcare workers now responding to the COVID-19 and the terrible circumstances that they're confronting in many places. So we're looking to expand our reach to other kinds of trauma survivors and to teach people about post-traumatic growth through training programs that are coming out of our Boulder Crest model.
It sounds fantastic. It actually sounds like a wonderful retreat for anyone to go on for a week in the log cabins.
Yes.
But are you? Is it your intention to develop a model that can be sort of franchised that someone else can create, or is the model really very dependent on the quality of the people doing it, on the expert companions and the professionals?
Well, we do want people to learn how to do this and to utilize it in all kinds of places. While at the same time, what you say is true, that we have to be, you have to be careful and understand what makes it work. And if you don't have the elements that make it work, then there's going to be a problem. You're not going to get the results. So we talk about some of the things that seem to make this work. One is the place where we do it. I mean, it's a place that is calming and beautiful and allows for people to be tranquil and peaceful. So setting has some importance. The people are important. You know, without expert companions, you're not going to get anywhere with this. Expert companions are important. So, for example, in our program, our expert companions are almost all veterans themselves, helping other veterans.
Yeah.
So they are not mental health people. They're not trained directly in mental health, like in school and graduate programs or anything like that. But we help these veterans become expert companions for their fellow veterans. And so people who understand that culture and know how to connect and are expert companions, we call them in the program, we call them expert guides. And so that's another important thing. And all the people in the program all our, you know, our maintenance people, our culinary staff, everybody has that approach because everybody's relating in this way. So that's really important. And then they have to understand the philosophy, the post-traumatic growth philosophy, the philosophy that we call in our program here, struggling well, how to struggle well. And then finally, we have a program that's very thoroughly described, and we have a manual for the 7-day program that's 200 pages long that lays out what happens during all that time. So you have to know what to do and how to do it. So those are the four elements. We call them the four P's, the place, the philosophy, the people, and the program that seem to result in the kind of outcomes. So we're trying to train this for other people in other places. So we're really getting up to speed on training now.
Oh, that's great. I can't think of a better time. Is there any particular advice that you would have to the therapists who I'm sure will be listening to this podcast, who right at the moment, they are the ones generally that people turn to either when they feel they're not coping with the trauma, or even in the course of ordinary therapy about something else where trauma is not the presenting complaint, a history of trauma comes up. Is there something in particular you'd like to see a therapist do or at least know about?
Well, it's the case that in recent years in the area of psychotherapy across disciplines of psychotherapy for psychologists, clinical social workers, counselors, whatever, that there's been an right. emphasis so much on technique of certain kinds of therapies, cognitive behavioral therapies generally. And people have been really learning these techniques of prolonged exposure and cognitive processing therapy and eye movement and desensitization and reprocessing and all these techniques. And yeah. what I'm afraid of is that people have lost some of the human element of therapy in our stress on these techniques. So we are focusing on this expert companionship model and how to bring that back into therapy more of a central focus. And research in psychotherapy, if you really look at the research in psychotherapy carefully, you'll find that relationship factors, what are often called common factors, factors that reach across techniques, in factors that have to do with the relationship that therapists have with their clients, are most important, more important than these kinds of techniques themselves. It's the basic stuff without which nothing good is going to come. You have to have this strong relationship of trust and this relationship of openness and connection. So I want therapists to rediscover the importance of this. And there are some important people in the therapy literature who have been writing about this in recent times and bringing us back into a focus in this part of the psychotherapy tradition. So that's one thing I want them to know. And the other thing I want them to know is this post-traumatic growth model you can integrate into your therapy, no matter what kind of therapy you're doing. It's a conception that fits with forward-looking, future-oriented approach to people's lives. And it's a natural process that people go through anyway without therapy. People go through it all the time without therapy in the context of good expert companionship. So we're building on something that's a natural process. So we facilitate that. We don't create it. We just facilitate this process that's naturally occurring and encourage it in people and provide expert companionship maybe when there isn't a lot around for an individual. We can also apply this sort of philosophy beyond individuals to couples or families or communities or societies where we see growth coming out of traumatic events. And in the time we have now with this terrible virus and it's affecting people all over the world, we're going to see social changes. And we have to encourage positive social changes in response to all this. Societies can grow and develop in positive ways coming out of this terrible experience. We can treat each other differently. We can recognize the value of different people in our society. You know, maybe we start to recognize the value of people like those folks in the grocery stores or those who pick up our trash or our basic medical workers, the people who go to the hospitals every day and do difficult and sometimes miserable tasks to help us get well. You know, those people who are, who've been underappreciated, that are so crucially important to us now, that we recognize if they aren't doing their jobs now, we're in deep trouble. Those are the essential workers. Our first responders, those people who are EMTs and, you know, firefighters and people like that who are, you know, handling the emergencies. You know, people are underappreciated. So, you know, I think there are social changes that are coming in the aftermath of this. And I hope that they are ones that we encourage.
Well, we see them happening. So they're happening already. And yes, I hope there'll be more of that. Well, Rich, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I appreciate it so much. Before you go, though, tell us, what would you recommend to our listeners who want to learn more about post-traumatic growth and how to be an expert companion or guide?
Well,
what should they read?
Yeah, well, you mentioned this book at the outset, and the book you mentioned on post-traumatic growth is an academic book, but yes. We have just published a book last month at Bouldercrest, which I think would be it's meant for the general reader, and it's called Transformed by Trauma, Stories of Post-Traumatic Growth. And what it is a description of this post-traumatic growth process illustrated with stories from military veterans and their families who have been through all sorts of different kinds of traumatic events. So we find in that book, we find mothers of service members, we find service members themselves who are males and females, all kinds of different people represented in these stories. And we use the stories in their own words, the interviews we've done with these people, to illustrate this process of post-traumatic growth that I've been describing. So this brand new book, Transformed by Trauma, is, I think, a nice, accessible way to learn more about post-traumatic growth for anyone who's interested in getting through their own traumatic circumstances or helping somebody else.
That's terrific. Thank you so much. Thank you very much, Rich, for your important work and for being on the show today. Take care. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Renee. Bye now.